important part of his research and liked it quite well. This is, you know, the kind of thing where, you know, we have to pay close attention, before we use somebody like Carl Jung, because his influence on the faith is not a positive one, I don't think. And that we have to, be very careful to avoid, you know, using his false, ideas that, you know, really lead us to hold propositions that contradict our faith. He taught strongly that Jesus was born in the sign of Pisces because it's part of the age of Pisces starting with the time of Christ. He taught that and believed it quite strongly. And, you know, taught a lot of other occult things about Christ, but did not believe in Christ's divinity. That he rejected. And he rejected himself as a Christian. Here, let me give you a quote when he took his first communion in his father's church. His father was a minister. And this is what Jung said about his first communion on page 55 of his autobiography. I had observed no sign of communion or of union, becoming one with. With whom? With Jesus? Yet he was only a man who died 1860 years ago. Why should a person become one with him? He was called the Son of God, a demigod, and therefore like the Greek heroes. How then could an ordinary person become one with him? This was called the Christian religion, but none of it had anything to do with God as I experienced him. Well, that doesn't sound like the attitude of a Christian at all. And yet, this is a guy who is used in Christian circles. Now, I gave a lecture about this. As a matter of fact, I wasn't even lecturing about Jung. Somebody asked me about Jung, and I gave couple of responses why I didn't like Jung. And the man who was in charge of catechism for the Archdiocese of Brisbane, Australia, was furious with me. He was sputtering. He was so angry. But all of your quotes are from Jung's autobiography. I said, well, yeah, that's true, but that's because that's where he said what he believed. He doesn't say what he believes in his other books. This is where he said what he believes. That's what I disagree with. And if Jung says explicitly that he is not a Christian and disagrees with Christian doctrine, I'm going to take him seriously when he's writing at the end of his life in his autobiography saying what he truly believed, not what he used in scientific garb. So it's because of this that I have a lot of problems. And finally, let me just mention something about the Myers-Briggs, because some of you have come across it. I'll get a lot of questions about the Myers-Briggs. What do I think of it? You know, it's something that in and of itself is probably basically harmless in and of itself. When the Myers-Briggs has been tested by psychologists and psychotherapists, it has been shown to be unreliable as a predictor of behavior. In other words, people who take Myers-Briggs can make it come up with any result they want if they know it well enough. And so it's not a very reliable tool. And I have yet to meet professional psychologists who use it because it is so unreliable. They don't use it in psychotherapy. So that's from the professional point of view. Where I would have a problem with it as a spiritual director and as a priest is when I hear, and this is again a report, one man who was a novice in a religious order had his first conference with his master novices, and the master novices sat him down and said, what are your letters on the Myers-Briggs? So he gave him his Myers-Briggs results. And he said, okay. And he looks up in a book that the guy had on his lap, the master novice on his lap, looks up that combination, said, oh, you are like this, like this, like this, like this, and like this. Time out. You don't use a test like that to tell somebody what they're like. If you're going to be a spiritual director, you have to listen to what's going on in that person's life. And maybe if there was something that helped you interpret something, that would be one thing, perhaps. But even then, you have to be careful. You have to tell somebody what their read their personality to them the first time you meet them out of a book. That is dumb as a box of rocks. A second problem I have with it as a spiritual director is when people use the Myers-Briggs to say far more than it possibly can say. For instance, you have books written, if you are an introvert, you should pray this way. If you're an extrovert, you pray this way. Where did they do their research? What can they use to back that theory up? That makes no sense to me. You know, when you're listening and praying, it's not some technique that you can just sort of say, oh, you do this and you do this and this goes here and this goes there. It's not that kind of an automatic system. Prayer life is a matter of listening to God and responding to God's grace. How is God our Lord moving you? What's happening? And then the spiritual director should be sensitive to what's happening and try to stay out of the way of what God is doing in your life so that God can be God of your life. And not to impose these interpretations on what you should be doing. It's your listening to God's grace that is crucial. And I get very concerned about some of this in being introduced to Catholic circles. Finally, one other thing. This is not about Carl Jung, but it is something from the New Age movement that is affecting Catholic circles. I don't know if any of you saw me on McNeil Lair Report on Good Friday this year. I did a little bit of a comment about centering prayer. You saw that? Yeah. I have some problems with centering prayer. I know that that's fairly popular. Again, I'm not against being quiet and having quiet prayer. No, I have no difficulty with that at all. But let me give you a little history as far as I understand it and a little bit of my critique. Pope Paul VI asked the Trappists to investigate Oriental religions because so many people in Western countries were flocking to Oriental religions in the 60s and 70s, as I described, as part of what became the New Age movement. So they were asked to investigate this to see what's attractive and how can we Catholics respond to the need that people are feeling, that they want to go off to meditate as Hindus and Buddhists instead of as Christians. Well, at Spencer, Massachusetts Abbey, they brought in some folks from Transcendental Meditation of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, both the introductory course and the Advanced Siddhi course. And they took this and they adapted it to Christianity. Now, and they eliminated the most specifically Buddhist or Hindu elements of it, to be sure. Transcendental meditation is a technique by which you take a series of classes. Then you get a mantra. This is just your sacred word and only for you. And you cannot get this sacred word until you go through a puja. Now, at the end of the course, you have to do a puja. A puja is a ceremony by which you sacrifice white cotton cloth, flowers, and fruit to Hindu gods, including Guru Dev, the teacher of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who is now considered to be a Hindu god. There are 30 million Hindu gods and growing all the time, like the rest of the population. The gods continue to grow too. And Guru Dev is now considered by many of them to be a god. And you have to do this puja or this sacrifice to the gods. And they do it in Sanskrit, I think, Sanskrit or Hindi. So you don't know what's being said. You don't realize that it's a sacrifice to other gods and that you are being led in worship and praise and adoration of these gods, including this man, Guru Dev. And I can prove that because there's an organization called TMX by ex-Transcendental Meditators who have translated the puja. And I got a copy from them of how it goes. So it's clear that this is a false sacrifice. And any Catholic or any Christian or Jew who participates in such a puja is breaking the first commandment. We may not worship any other gods but the one true God. So it's a very serious sin to participate in that puja, and yet the Transcendental Meditation people won't give you your sacred word unless you do. Now, the Trappists eliminated that because they knew that that was off base. So there's none of that to do with centering prayer at all. That's all gone from centering prayer. But what they, and also just to let you know, the sacred word, the mantra that only is yours, that is not only yours. What they did is they gave it to people according to their gender and their age. So women of a certain age group all got the same mantra. Men of a certain age group all got the same mantra. It had nothing to do with you just getting your personal sacred word. There was just a list that they gave you by gender and age. So that was just nonsense. But the Trappists also eliminated giving a Hindu mantra. Transcendental meditation. Get into a comfortable position. Not necessarily a lotus position, just a comfortable position where you can then take that word and, along with your breathing, repeat that word again and again. And the goal of centering prayer is to empty your mind as a way to prepare you for meditation. Though sometimes they say that it is your prayer and meditation. They're not consistent on that. Well, I have a problem with that. When the apostles asked our Lord to teach us how to pray, our Lord never said, empty your brain. He never said, empty your mind. He never taught that any place. This is something that the Trappists have gotten, not from the Bible or from Christian tradition, but from transcendental meditation and yoga in general. Their goal is to empty your mind. That's not our goal. Christian prayer is not to seek some state of consciousness where your mind is empty. You're trying to seek the fullness of Christ. That's the goal of Christian prayer, Christ's fullness. And so I have a major problem with that approach. Also, I'm concerned at times. I think Abbot Thomas Keating has changed some of his teaching on this. But one of my other concerns about it is I'm not sure where they see the role of God's grace in prayer. Originally, it didn't have much of a place. Now Abbot Keating is talking more about the role of God's grace, and God has given you grace to pray. But we have to keep in mind that that prayer is a result of God's grace. Prayer is not some technique by which we can control our relationship with God. Prayer is a listening to God and a responding to His loving grace. And that God is the one who takes the initiative. God is the one who, treats us as His beloved and seeks us out. And we are to respond to Him respond by His grace. So I'm very concerned about that element as well, not being very clear in the centering prayer process. I'm also concerned that the technique learned from transcendental meditation, like transcendental meditation, is a form of self-hypnosis. And that there's a confusion of a natural ecstasy with spirituality. Christian spirituality is not something that you do by self-hypnosis. It's something that, again, is response from God's grace. And I'm very concerned that people are using this as a means to induce a certain trance-like state that feels very comfortable, but is not necessarily Christian prayer. Christian prayer is not a focus on some state of consciousness. It's a relationship with the three-personal God, the tri-personal God. And that it's going to have an inherently personal relationship element to it, not a state of consciousness. And I think that that is something that we have to keep very key. Now, many people who are practicing centering prayer are focusing on Christ. That I have no problem with. But when they say, have no thoughts, have no emotions, hold on to no thought even about Christ, then I have a problem. I want Christ to fill my mind and my heart. When I pray, I want Him to become the focus of my life. That's the goal of my prayer. Union with Him, not emptiness. And I don't think we should confuse it with Lectio Divina, which was a medieval form of prayer where you took a small verse of scripture and kept on repeating it. Not to empty your mind, but to unite your mind and your heart with Christ. Our Lord didn't give us a mind to say, go ahead and use your mind except when you're with me. You know, put it on the shelf when you come to me, but everybody else can use their mind. That's not true. And again, I'm not trying to say that, you know, the essence of prayer is thinking either, you know, that it's all, you know, cogitating and it's doing theology. It's not that, but we don't disengage our mind. They, by not having any thoughts, they would have no thoughts at all. Have your mind completely empty. That's typical of Oriental religion, because the goal of Oriental religion is to become empty and realize the illusion of your life and how you are part of the one being. It's only when you're empty that you're part of the oneness and that you should cease to exist. That's a goal of Hinduism. That's not a goal of Christianity at all. Again, our goal is union with Christ. And finally, in terms of my critique of it, let me start off with this. There are studies by transcendental meditation proponents which say that use of transcendental meditation leads to more creativity. However, there are also about 85 psychological studies by independent psychologists which show that long-term use of transcendental meditation, 6 months and more, that is, brings on depersonalization, dissociation from your personality, and clinically psychological depression. Long-term use of TM leads to these results in 85 different studies showing depression and depersonalization as the result. Will the same thing happen as a psychological response to centering prayer? I don't think there have been any studies on it, you know, and I don't know. But if it happens with TM, why wouldn't it happen with centering prayer? You know, I want to know. Well, if there's a difference, what is the difference and why? But I think that this is something I have to be very careful of and not get carried away and off into other things. Okay? All right. Let's take just a stretch break. If you need to, you know, take a minute or two to go to the restroom, and then let's just take a 3 minute break, and then we'll do questions and answers. Okay? All right. Thank you. Oh, great. Great. We'll even get some chalk eventually. Is there any influence of Carl Gustav Jung in the feminist theology? Again, you have to keep in mind, feminist theology is all over the place. There's no one set of doctrine. There's quite a few different doctrines. And some feminists are strongly influenced by Jung. Others will also take apart the word therapist and they say, you know what that really means? The rapist. You know, I mean, if a guy committed rape, then he's a rapist. But if he's a therapist, he's not a rapist. That's, you can go to him or not. You don't have to go to see a therapist. But, you know, some feminists can't stand psychotherapy and psychiatry. Others use it as a basis for their doctrine. And they'll try to use ideas from Jung to support it. But also keep in mind that they'll use ideas from pseudo-history. For instance, I'll give you an example. Did you realize that, you know, in the Neolithic times and earlier, people worshiped female gods, and as a result, the goddesses helped them to share, and that there was a system of communism, basically, and no private ownership while there were people worshiped goddesses. It's only when they started to worship gods, male deities, that there was an idea of private ownership. And this is not unusual in feminist circles. Well, that's nonsense. And also that in the time of worshiping the goddesses, there were no wars. That's nonsense. Matter of fact, in Paleolithic times, you see that there was cannibalism. Now, usually you don't cannibalize something because they asked you to. You know, usually you have to cannibalize them by force. You know, people, I mean, who walks up and says, would you like to eat my body? Okay, sure. No, I mean, it's not that way. And so, you know, that's a false sense of history. It just doesn't fit ancient records at all. So yes, some feminists are influenced by Jung. Some are influenced by Engels. As a matter of fact, that's where that theory comes from, that there were originally goddesses and everybody owned everything in common. That came from Engels, of Marx and Engels, you know, that duo. Came up with that theory. And that influences feminists too. You know, there are all sorts of things that influence them, and Jung was influenced among some of them, not all of them by any means. Is women's ordination influenced by Jungian theology? Some people in charge of women's ordination are. Others are not. So it's not universal. Okay? I have to pay attention to what they say. Though I do have quotes that my friend Donna Steichen gathered of leaders at the Women's Ordination Conference, where they say their purpose is not to become priests, but to destroy the priesthood. They say that explicitly at their meetings. And she can give the quotes that this is a hierarchical structure. It has to be ended. And true feminism wants to see the end of it, but we'll have to become priests so we can destroy it from inside. Others also say that they want to use the priesthood as a way to get influence inside the Catholic Church so that we can change Catholic doctrine on abortion. And then others, and contraception, because men don't understand on that. You have one of them in Boston who says that if women had been ordained priests from the beginning, abortion would be a sacrament. I'm not exaggerating at all. She even came up with a liturgy for having an abortion. You know, for a post-abortion liturgy. You know, so this is the kind of thing that some feminists do. Others don't want to do anything with that at all. And other two people want women's ordination for totally other reasons. You know, there are a lot of people who want women's ordination for a variety of reasons, but those are some of them. Jung might be some influence, but, you know, he's not the only one or even the dominant one. How did Jung's theology creep into Catholic circles? Again, the reason for it was Jung believes in spirituality. He believed in the spiritual world. So people said, well, he's spiritual and we're spiritual, so we'll sort of use him. And that's how a good deal of it's gotten in. Do you have any background information on the popular writer Marianne Williamson? Is she a New Ager? She appears so to me. Good, because she is. She's totally New Age, to the max, dudes. And she's a very popular teacher within the New Age movement. She's an evangelist for A Course in Miracles. And she has dozens of tapes and a couple of books, two, three books, evangelizing this book, Course in Miracles. And Marianne Williamson is very New Age in what she's doing. And we talked about Course in Miracles last night. This is something on centering prayer. What if someone believes it's a grace received from God to prepare themselves for prayer by centering? Well, again, it's, you know, one of the issues that I have no problem with it is you're seeking prayer, that you're seeking a grace from God to be centered and focused on God. I still don't think that a person is going to have their mind emptied. That I don't think is going to happen. And that, you know, God who gave you the grace of having a mind is I don't think gives us the grace to empty it. And that's where I'm concerned. Somebody else asked a question. I'm concerned with some changes at my parish. My pastor no longer says the penitential rite. Prayer at the beginning of Mass. There are no bells or kneelers. Are these changes related to the New Age or just the New American Catholic Church? Thank you. Again, I can't answer that because I don't know your pastor. And this relates to another question How do we deal with the influence of the New Age movement in our church and in our catechists? This is the walk away. Who said that? Don't walk away. Don't walk away, because then they win. We have to evangelize them. We don't want to walk away from them. We want to convert them to the Catholic faith. And if you walk away, you can't do that. Now, there might be times, first thing that you need to do with your pastor, who's, say, making changes, getting rid of the kneelers and things like that, it's important to ask and try to do this with, as much openness as possible. Why are you doing this? Ask them why you're doing this. Find out what he's thinking and why he's thinking it. That's the first step. I don't know why he's doing it. And assume that you don't either. You know, I may have some ideas about it, but try not to impose what you think he might be thinking, but listen to what he says about his reasons. Ask them to explain the reasons. Same thing with the catechists. If they're teaching, the kids to, like I've seen, to become leaves. And imagine that you're a leaf when you pray. Ask them, why are you doing that? Then you also can start to get the reasons. In general, as you get them to talk about what they're doing and why they're doing it, as you get them to describe it in as much as possible, usually they will give you plenty of rope to hang them with. The more you know about their reasons, the more you can do this. For instance, one thing that I complained about at a chapel where I attend, usually where I just go to pray, actually, is, they for Lent, a liturgist came and took out all the water from the holy water fonts and put sand in there. And I said, now, what am I supposed to do with this? You want me to make a mess on your floor and make the sign of the cross with sand? You're going to have piles of dirt all over your floor. Why did you do this? And he said, well, does it make you upset? I said, no, it's just stupid. I said, oh, I thought if you were upset, then you should go back and pray about it. But I said, no, it doesn't make me upset. It's just stupid. I don't know what to do with this. This isn't part of our tradition. This isn't Catholic. In the Triduum, from Holy Thursday Mass until the blessing of water on the vigil, then we don't have any holy water, but not for all of Lent. And we certainly don't put dirt in the holy water font. We leave it empty. That's what our liturgy is. And I said, you really need to rethink this. And then I went to those who were in charge, and I got them to at least put one holy water font with water in it. Because I asked a bunch of people, do you like this? You like this? Nobody liked it, except the liturgist, because this is in the liturgy magazines. So they gave us back one holy water font anyway. And which people then went to. They wanted holy water. They wanted to bless themselves. They wanted to remind themselves of their baptism, not of their burial. So this was literally as dumb as dirt. Now, by going to the people involved and finding out what they're doing and why they're doing it, you can make some changes sometimes. Now, not always. After you find that there's no hope for any change and that they just won't do anything, then walk and let them know it. But first of all, we have to try and convert them back to Catholicism. Ask them what's going on. Father, why are there no kneelers? I love to adore my Jesus. I love to bow down and kneel before him. To the best of my arthritis allows me to do so. Why did you take away kneelers? Maybe you don't want to kneel, but the rest of us do. And it's not your church, Father. You are assigned here. We pay for the kneelers. We pay when you take them out. We pay when you leave and put them back in. You move on. And this is the kind of thing that we have to, you know, say, wait a minute, what's happening here? Why? Ask them to explain themselves and them to push it. And sometimes they don't want to, but the number of things you can do. Now, I tell people, don't write the Pope. That's stupid. He can't do anything about it. You know how many parishes there are in the world? Think you're the only one with a kook for a pastor? You know, you don't write the Pope. You write to his immediate superior. Or, you know, in the case of, say, it's a catechist, his or hers, or a principal of a school or whatever. You go to the person immediately above them. And you always, always keep a copy of your letters. Always. So that when the next person doesn't listen to you, you send them a copy of the first letters you wrote, any response that you got, and you send and you keep a copy of the second letter you write to the next guy. And all the way up the scale, you always keep copies and send every guy that you send the higher up to, send copies of your previous correspondence. Eventually, somebody's going to realize if I don't do something about it, he's going to send something to my boss. My boss is going to hear about it. So, you know, they've somewhere along the line. Secondly, it's very important, especially if it's liturgical abuse, to get a hold of your data. Know what the church teaches about the liturgy. And there's, I'm going to try and look it up here on my computer. I think I've got an address that will help you. There are two organizations that are going to be helpful. One is called the St. Joseph Foundation in San Antonio, Texas. The man who started that got a degree in canon law. It's only a master's degree. He's not a full canon lawyer. But when he did a master's in theology, he did it in canon law. So that he could learn as much about canon law as possible. Let me see. Yeah, here it is. Charles Wilson of the St. Joseph Foundation. I'll give you their address. 11107 Wurzbach. W-U-R-Z-B-A-C-H. Wurzbach. W-U-R-Z-B-A-C-H. In San Antonio, Texas. My San Antonio Rose lives. 78230. That's their zip code. He helps people to deal with these questions. Also, there is another group that Father Fessio has just helped to start in Alexandria, Virginia. And this group is called Adoremus. Let me see if I can find the guy who's in charge of that. Have you heard of that yet? Good. And let me see if I can find it there. They can't find it. I can't remember the guy who started that. I'll try to look through it later on. But Adoremus in Alexandria is specifically trying to help people get information about correct liturgy, the way the liturgy is supposed to be done, according to canon law and liturgical law. See, canon law and liturgical law are two different sets of law. I have to keep that clearly in mind. You know, the liturgical rules are not in canon law. There are certain norms in canon law about liturgy, but the liturgical laws are not there. And it's important to know what's going on. Also, I recommend, because he's not a liberal or conservative, but I like his books. This guy, Thomas Day, he has two books, Why Catholics Can't Sing, and Where Have You Gone, Michelangelo? They're excellent. And his critique of the new music is so wonderful, as being so inherently egocentric, the new music. And he just nails them. nails him on this stuff. You know, and as a matter of fact, I'd seen some of this stuff before. That's why I liked his book. But you look at some of the music books and look in this segment of the hymns called Community. And all of the hymns on, or most of the hymns on Community in the Worship and Praise, but not the Red Book. But the ones from the newer hymns. When you look at that, all the hymns on Community is how great we are, instead of saying to God, how great thou art. You know, it's all how great we are. We are the light of the world. Let light shine upon us. You know, it's all the stuff about we do. We're here. God, are you not lucky to have us? You know, now that's not New Age. That's just egocentric and narcissistic. And, you know, these guys are good. So these are some sources to deal with liturgical problems. Now, in some cases, maybe a pastor is being kind of New Agey, but not necessarily. Not necessarily. It could just be that he's, you know, doesn't have faith in what Catholicism believes anymore. I don't know. But that's just guessing. You need to find out from the pastor, why do you do this? Sometimes the pastor is intimidated by a liturgist and is afraid to do what not to do what the liturgist says. They're just intimidated by the liturgist. You know, find out what's going on and respond to it, and then try to get them to change first. You know, that we want the Vatican II Mass. Yes, ma'am. What if he's teaching that some parts of the Bible are campfire stories and not real history? Well, first of all, some of the parts of the Bible are campfire stories. There's Egyptian jokes in there. When you know enough, when you read some of this stuff, sometimes I'll be reading my Bible. I usually read it in Hebrew, the Old Testament. And they're telling Egyptian jokes, and they're puns that you just don't get in English. And there are some campfire stories. Ah, I remember the Egyptians. You know, and they're work songs, all sorts of things. Does that mean that they're untrue? Not everything that you say around the campfire is untrue. He said, okay, then the man is an ignoramus. He hasn't studied his biblical theology. All right. And anybody who looks at that, the first five books as a campfire story, again, there are some campfire stories in there, largely because all those people lived in tents. They all lived around a campfire. All right. That's where they told their stories. They didn't have anything except camps. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were campers. And God was a camper. Remember, the tent of meeting was a tent. And so there was all campfires. But, you know, that doesn't mean... And there's also a wide variety of other literature in there. And that's not campfire literature by any means. And also to call campfire literature is to say that it's imply that it's of a vulgar or less literary quality. It's high quality literature. And if he's read any ancient literature besides the Bible, he'll see what a quality of difference it is. And if he knows any archaeology and other things, you'll see that it's not, you know, nonsense. You know, and this is absurd. So, I mean, oftentimes that's a factor of who taught him theology. Some of these guys just, you know, were taught theology. They might not even be ignoramuses. They might be very bright. But they were taught, you know, a lot of modernist theology. Now, it's not New Age by any means. It's just a loss of faith by their teachers. And, you know, at that point you're dealing with sometimes a basic lack of faith. And you have to, you know, deal with that. That's a real problem. Yes, ma'am. Yes, mine too. Mm-hmm. Sure. Right. There are a number of New Age pseudotherapies being brought in. For instance, healing touch, which is started by a nurse, and is spread among, there are courses in it, and degrees in it, from what I understand, being offered. And it has no provable therapeutic value. It's never been proven therapeutically to be effective. And yet people, there was some flimsy study. They used that flimsy study to support it. And, you know, whereas it's been disproven by other studies and shown to be a flimsy study, but this is they grab onto it. And first of all, in any kind of, scientific realm like medicine, you have the obligation to demand the evidence. Where has this been tested with a double-blind study? That is that not the norm for any therapy? Where are your double-blind studies? And you, again, as a nurse, and you as patients, also be aware. Where do you have more than anecdotal evidence? You know, we have, by anecdotal evidence, it says, well, I knew somebody who once took a divining rod, and they made it work on their arthritis or whatever, you know. They whacked themselves on the head with it, and they felt better when it stopped, you know. I'm just making something up, but that's sometimes it's just as goofy. And you have to ask, you know, those kind of scientific questions. Don't just say, well, I knew somebody who did it once, and it worked. You know, when I tried this, I mentioned I have arthritis, and I take this New Zealand green lip muscle extract. These people were all telling me this. I said, don't give me your heebie-jeebie medicine here. And I said, no, really, it works. It works, it works. They promised it. And I said, I'll give it 24 hours. If it doesn't help me within that time, I have to go back to my medicine. I need to walk because I can't. And it worked. All right. And it continues to work. All right, fine. But I still don't know why it works. And my doctor, who is amazed because my Rh factors are pretty high, and he keeps trying to make it hurt. I said, it doesn't hurt. What, you don't have any reaction. There's no swelling. And I tell him what I use. And he says, well, we need to investigate this to find out why it works. I am 100% in favor of that. We should. That's science. And medicine should be science. New Agers, you know, are in this dream world. Well, maybe this could work. You know, and you just can't deal with that. And be careful, careful, careful. And as a nurse or a doctor or a patient, ask for the evidence of where are the double-blind studies to support this. And I think, you know, as a nurse, where this stuff is being introduced, keep on challenging them for that. If you want, there's an article on healing touch in the Christian Research Journal, the cover article, I think, of this last winter. They're in Irvine, California. You know, look up their phone number, and it's 714 area code, and they can get you an article on the critique of it from scientists. There's also a book called New Age Medicine by two doctors. Look in, as a matter of fact, for that, I can't remember the author of that, but if you look in my book in the bibliography, I have New Age Medicine listed in there, and that also has its own medical bibliography. It's a critique by doctors of New Age claims for acupuncture and, you know, crystal healing. I mean, some of these people are trying to give crystal elixirs, where you take a crystal, put it in the water, and you get the essence of the crystals, and you drink that. You know, one of the components of many crystals is arsenic. That's not good for your health. As I understand, call me crazy, but I don't think that arsenic is good for you. Maybe if you have enough healing light energy that it doesn't bother you, but I don't believe it. I don't believe it. And, you know, you have to be careful with this stuff. Some of it is actually dangerous. And, you know, we have to take a look at the science involved. So that would be my response. And I read some of the New Age claims, too. But, no, it's, you know, when you look at them, it's every time it's anecdotal. Same thing with homeopathic medicine. You know, some of the homeopathic medicines may work, but not because of the reasons they give for it. There might be some other things in there. I mean, we've looked to, you know, home cures to help with a variety of things. For instance, even the use of camphor you know, to heal aching muscles. They don't really know why it works. They have a couple of theories. They don't know for sure why that works. It might be that it causes enough burning that you forget about the other pain. Your body learns to forget the pain. That's one of the theories of why camphor works. And tiger balm and all that stuff that you put on, it might work just because the body, just like when you get an owie and your mommy kisses it and rubs it, you know, when you hurt your knee and your mom rubs it when you're a little kid, it might be that that rubbing of it takes away your pain from that, because it's your body's nerves are focusing on having your mom rub your owie. Okay, well, it might be the same theory, but they don't. There's a lot of stuff doctors don't know either. They just don't understand a lot of aspirin, even how that works. It's just been recently studied to have some better ideas. They didn't know why. They just knew it worked. But and they showed that it did work. They didn't know why. Well, this is what we want to do with science. We don't want the New Agers to take over the science. Does that help? Yeah, and I think it's Roser did the book on New Age medicine. But look at my bibliography. Just flip through there, you'll see it.